121st JBST.com Smartcast, a question and answer special released for October 2013. This is the multi-sport podcast for triathletes, duathletes, sportive riders, road racers, time trialists, runners, mountain bikers, and pretty much any fitness enthusiast.
Whatever your distance or whatever your event, this podcast aims to make you smarter and faster.
Thank you for downloading this 121st episode. I'm Coach Joe Beer, and once again, I'm joined by Cyfort Racing's retail manager, excellent cyclocross, mountain bike, triathlon, and pretty much any sport he's ever put his hand to, Martin Crocker.
Well, you've used the word excellent, I think, and unfortunately, you put me on a pedestal there, Joseph.
I know. We'll kick you off by the end of it, don't worry. For new listeners, there is a back library. I think it goes at present because some get shoved off the back of the back library. But I think we're up to about summer 2010, so you've got a few years' worth to go back over. So this is the Q&A special. Jump in with some quick news. Come on, Martin. Very quick, 30 seconds on the World Championship time trial.
The only thing I've seen so far is the team time trial. That's all I've seen.
And?
Very impressive.
Oh.
And the world's longest, straightest road, I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
They were running through on the telly.
Running?
Of course.
I'm on cycling.
On showing the map, and it was literally, you got through the town, and then bang, long, straight road, until you came into another little town, and a couple of roundabouts, and that was it. In. But very impressive. Very impressive.
Cool. I saw bits of the individual when they were alongside Cancellara. Boy, he can make a disc wheel buzz, can't he?
He can make a bike move.
Yeah, it was like, absolutely phenomenal.
Well, they were saying Wiggins and Tony Martin, their times in the individual would have put them in the top 10 for the team time trial.
Wow, that was impressive. What else? We're going to go through some tweets. We'll do that in a bit because some of those are questions. Quick bit of information, the Mallorca Bike Camp will be the 22nd to the 29th of March. Details will go up at Nirvana Europe in about the next week. The Club La Santa camp is full. Martin Crocker has yet to confirm whether he's going to be there or not. His dates and schedules are so tight, he's not sure.
Oh, they are crammed.
There was a tweet. So this tweet happened just after the London Triathlon, you know, the World Championship, World Championships series race. And I tweeted and said, the UKs were wearing dry robes. Did you see that?
I did. I actually saw your tweet.
Oh, you saw my tweet?
Yes.
And a guy called Steve Shackleton said, thanks, Joe. I'll check it out. If it's good enough for Johnny Brownlee et al, it's good enough for me. And I gave him the link, which was wandering-star.co.uk. And they were visibly using them before the race. And I know that the triathlon people in London suddenly went, oh, it's going to be cold. Oh, it's going to be wet. I know, we need some of those. We want the athletes to be in those. And that... it was one of those days where it could have been quite warm, could have been sort of coldish, but they did say it's quite cold.
Yeah, the guys looked quite cold on the bikes, didn't they?
Yeah, and the day the morning of that race, because it was in the afternoon, the standard distance was reduced to 750 metres.
That's right, yeah.
People didn't say it was brassic to the extent that it had to be done, but... Such was the decision that it was 750 metres.
Yeah, a couple of guys that I know went and did it. So, and they were saying that the swim was reduced down, which they couldn't quite understand. But I suppose it's rules is rules. So yeah, but well done to the guys that took part. So fantastic.
Okay, first tweet. I'm going to give this one to you, actually. Because
I never said I had to be able to read.
Yes, I did. I did. I think you had it a moment ago, actually. And it was that one. Because I think you quite like that one.
So this one is from Tim Tanner. So it says to Coach Beer, Coach Joe Beer and Southport Racing. First year newbie to try. Absolutely loving it. Just found your podcast. You guys crack me up. Great listen. Thanks for that, Tim. Well, we aim to please. I think Joe aims to please, and I aim to entertain, I'm pretty sure.
You could be right, actually.
Yeah.
There was a... we'll get it up. There was a iTunes review as well, which spoke highly of you, Martin.
I think it did.
I might have been imagining that, actually. Right, a tweet from... And this is a question, so we're straight into the Q&As. From try_Eyed, EYED... And he says, what is the optimum cadence for triathlon time trialing? And I'd like to add to the end of that, and mountain biking, because you could enlighten us with the last part of the question. Yeah. So in your heady days of time trialing, Martin, what was your optimum cadence?
I think you've got...
I never counted.
No, I never really took much note. Until people started to ask you the questions like, well, do you think I should have a slow cadence, a high cadence, you know? You have... I feel as though you've got a natural cadence. You have got a natural cadence. There's no two ways about it. But my experience with reference to triathlon was it was easier to go a slightly higher cadence to be able to then run off the bike,
yeah.
I found, without having to load your legs up. But the only thing is you get a bit pulled into kind of your TTing, your time trialing, by trying to get on top of a big gear,
yeah.
by trying to mash on the pedals. So you tend to lose a bit of finesse, especially for a triathlete. You know, I think sometimes you're better off maintaining a relatively high cadence through time trialing if you're a triathlete. If you're doing it as a cycling event to kind of keep you on top, then I would say you wanted to probably aim for a bit quicker cadence than you probably would feel necessary. But with mountain biking, a lot of the guys now are running single rings on the front, 10 and 11 speed on the back.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You are limited to obviously how slow you can pedal,
yeah.
And how stalling.
Yeah.
So again, we've gone over to Q-rings. That's another thing that's gone over to the mountain bike. So I think a higher cadence is probably the better way to go. So around about kind of 90 to 100, and playing with it mountain biking as well. We found that a nice steady kind of 90 to 95 cadence seems to work perfectly without blowing your legs to pieces. But the good thing is now with such a nice spread of gears, you know, you've got a tight kind of like 11, 12 at the bottom of a mountain bike cassette. So a 32 or a 34 on the front, depending on the course, gives you plenty of gears to be able to get out of a bit of trouble, yeah. And to put down a sprint if you need to.
Yeah. And I guess I would... add to what you said by, you know, what's the optimal cadence, what you're trying to do,
yeah.
Because let's say you are a triathlete, optimal cadence in a triathlon would be probably something, you know, mid upper 80s, maybe just into the 90s, okay, because the power output isn't a maximal effort. If it's Ironman, you're working at about 55% of your ramp test, so that's relatively low, but for a long time. Even, you know, even short course races doing 25 miles, they're probably at around 60% to 65% of their peak. So this isn't, you know, this isn't like a 10-mile time trial on its own, where you'd be working at 80% of your peak. So I think you can have a lower cadence and be efficient, or you can rev. And if you rev, then you are softening it for your legs. But it's that whole thing, what do you want to do in a triathlon? Do you want to just make it as easy as possible on your legs? Well, if so, then yes, up the cadence a little bit. But what you've got to watch is too high a spinning rate and you're actually throwing legs around in circles don't do anything.
That's right,
and it's not, you know, when people look at elite riders, oh yeah, but they're doing over 100 RPM. Yes, but they're probably doing well over 400, you know, possibly, you know, approaching 450 or more watts. So they have to keep the cadence up, because for each level of power, there is an optimum cadence. Whereas the age grouper that on a, say, Ironman triathlon may put out 160 watts, that's pretty silly to spin at 100 RPM doing 160 watts. I mean, you're throwing your legs around, which are weight, to achieve something that's a fairly low amount of work.
I think also as well, as I mean, you can agree or disagree.
I might disagree.
No, this is very true. I think a person has a natural cadence, a natural speed.
Yeah, but is that more about habit than actual natural cadence?
Yes, I suppose so. Yeah. But then, you know, I've been fortunate enough to be able to. It is a bit of a boring thing to do training, but you know,
I've ridden
100, you know, 100 RPMs cadence wise, and to me it just felt odd. Like you said, it felt uncontrolled.
Yeah.
It felt as though you were almost tiring yourself out for no reason. But then when you drop it down to kind of the 90 to 95, I felt that far more productive. I felt the workout worked better, and then incorporated that into racing. And then obviously it comes out that anywhere between 90 and 95 seems to work for me. So I think sometimes it's well worth going out and having a bit of a cadence session in mind, and then just saying, look, I'm going to do 95 to 100, see how it goes. Yeah. And then, of course, if you feel as though you're attached to the pedals, but there's, you know, you're spinning frantically with no style or finesse, then maybe try a different cadence strategy from that.
So for in triathlons, we're reckoning upper 80s, maybe just into the 90s. For time trialing, slightly lower.
Yeah.
Because you don't have to consider getting off and running, so you can put everything out and therefore increase the amount of torque or work done by your legs. You don't have to consider that they're absolutely blown apart. And anyone that does a time trial and then tries to run afterwards will realise the difference.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Don't consider that you're going to run. Do it and then try and run, and you realise that that extra effort that you do over 10 or 25 miles would wreck you in a triathlon.
Yeah, yeah.
So you play around with it. So time trialing can be slightly lower and much more forceful, i.e. there is no run afterwards. Triathlon, whatever you don't put out on the bike, you leave for the run. And some people don't get that. So they are trying to push as hard as possible. It will affect your run. You cannot ultimately time trial at 100% of your time trial ability and it not affect your run. Everybody has a limit. And I think the other thing, like you said, was to play around with higher cadence and to do some softer souplesse riding where you rev it up a bit more and just teach your legs the bandwidth to be able to spin at 100. Therefore, 85, it's a piece of cake. And 85 at about 50 to 60% of your peak power is actually quite easy. It's controlling that's the key to then getting off. Because in a triathlon, you have one more event left. Even when people said, I did that pacing, but oh my God, I've not run as fast as that ever. It's like, yes, you do not give full gas on the bike. It is a triathlon, it's not a time trial. And I think the more you play around with the relative cadence and effort, the more you realise that triathlon is about controlling yourself and what's the optimum way. And it would make very little sense to spin at 100 RPM and get to the transition thing. Blimey, my legs have just literally got tired by the fact that I've been spinning too fast.
Yeah.
But you don't want to be one of these people that goes out, sticks it in the big chain ring and just grinds all day long, because they're just a one-trick pony. They haven't got the ability to fire efficiently because they've only ever done one type of sort of work.
Yeah. Yeah.
So play with the cadence. Play with the results that you get to see what difference it makes, but don't be fixed on a certain number is absolutely got to be right.
Yeah.
Because, you know, sometimes people want to rev a bit because their legs are starting to get a bit tighter, so they will rev very slightly higher but still put out the same amount of work. That means per pedal rev, the work that they're doing is dropped. So, you know, you don't have, you know, an absolute number for this, but I think high cadence teaching your legs the bandwidth of spinning, and then low cadence down to the 55-60 rev area and teach pure strength, pushing hard and you know, doing stuff that you wouldn't want to do in a triathlon because that would numb your legs and mean that you can't run. Look at runners. Runners typically will be maybe mid upper 80s, maybe 90 in terms of cadence. So whatever you do on the bike, if it sort of mirrors on the run from a neural point of view,
you're
kind of priming your body the right way. Mm. If you tried running at 100 cadence, you just look like something out of Wacky Races. I mean, it would look quite bizarre, particularly as most people's running is not so fast. You think they've got to move their legs at 100 RPM.
Yeah, that's it.
For each output, there's an optimum cadence.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent.
Okay, here's a tweet. We got one from a chap called Carl Fannin. Now, you might not remember him, Martin, but he sent us a question, and it was about the, I think it was like 15 plus hours training. We said, look, do this.
Yes, yeah.
He was travelling, I think, from Australia to London to do the Worlds.
That's right, yes.
And we had various forwards and backwards, and I said about the beetroot and stuff like that, and you know, to use standardised beetroot juice, etc., etc. And we talked about his training and making sure he recovered and stuff. Anyway, he sent a tweet, 10 a.m. 16th of September, date stamped, but a picture of his gold medal saying, thanks, JB, and of course Martin Crocker, for advice you gave me on the podcast a few months ago. I'm now age group sprint distance world champion.
There you go.
I can't quite see because I printed this out. I think it's, oh yeah, it's 35:39. So well done, Carl. Glad in some way. You know what? I think coaching podcasts, articles, books, whatever, you're not really doing the work for people. No. You've still got to sweat it out. You've done it. I hate for people to think that coaches do anything more than just push people in the right direction. It is about the toil and the effort and the decisions that ultimately an athlete makes. Because if you're totally reliant on your coach telling you when to breathe, when to sit down, when to stand up, you don't actually make the right decisions. So, Carl, you must have made a heck of a lot of good decisions. You must have travelled well. You must have got everything sorted and tapered and had the ability. And Bob's your uncle. Picture of a gold medal.
Brilliant.
I thought that was quite nice. Very nice for somebody to say so.
That's it. But then, you know, everybody's got their targets. If you all hit your targets, this kind of job, just, we wouldn't be giving advice, would we? Because people would be giving us advice pretty much by the end of it.
Yes,
which you can do.
Which you can do. Welcome.
Yeah,
far away.
Fantastic.
Right. So I've just found the iTunes review. Ooh, it's by Clanky69. 5 stars. And he says, for someone who is new to triathlon at 45, these podcasts are great for easing those fears. The guys are informative and friendly and put you at ease. Which guys? I don't know. Who are they?
Has he written the review about the right one?
I don't know. Very funny at times. Must be wrong. Must be. And some great pieces of useful training tidbits. Love it. Keep them coming.
Excellent.
Okay.
Well,
whatever, whoever's podcast you did that review for, thank you very much.
Yeah, we're having it now.
We're having it.
No, excellent.
Okay. Here's an email, and it's about genetics. So it follows on from what I said about Carl. You've got to have a good engine to train it right. And it's from a certain person called Lee Piercy.
Never heard of him.
No. good engine. Got his training sorted out. Won his age group at World Championships and duathlon. But he said, and this was in an email, and he said, you know, I can use it as a Q&A. He said, you once told me I chose the right parents, and triathlon duathlon is not a socialist sport. I've always trained far less than the vast majority of my peers, and although my body has been somewhat fragile, I've been extremely fortunate with genetics. Interestingly, my brother, who's 42, never cycled before, started training for Land's End John O'Groats in 2014, a few months ago. Already, he can hang on the wheel for 30 miles on a tempo ride and is beating all my mates who have been cycling for years. don't think you can ever underplay the role of genetics and how it plays a part, especially with part-time amateur athletes.
Yes, definitely.
And I think it's true. And it's not to set, you know, this phrase of a glass ceiling. But ultimately, we have. You are training your abilities. Or the more I look at it, and the more I look into the sort of successes of people, you're trying to train your limiting factors.
Yeah.
There's only so much you can get out of your VO2, your peak power, all these factors. People that are champions are effectively born and developed over a long period of time, but you cannot just, you know, take, you know, anybody's son or daughter and say, we're going to make you a world champion. I know the Russians and various, you know, Eastern European, you know, groups tried doing it, and they eventually found people, but, you know, you found one and broke 99. And I think the thing is with training, you're trying to get the most out of yourself, and sometimes that's about being better time managed, or have the equipment that doesn't let you down, or just be consistent and not let things like massive weight gain, inconsistency and stuff trip you over.
Yeah.
But we cannot all say, I am going to be world champion at whatever. But there's a heck of a enjoyable path to follow if you try and think, okay, in my situation with what I want to do, can I get those last few seconds? Because after a while, you realise roughly where people, if they're doing it right, end up. And they don't then say, you know, I'm really going to take myself serious and win. They've probably already had winning or fairly good age group performances already. There's very few champions you see that did nothing at school, never lifted a shot put or a tennis racket or anything, and somehow automatically win something. You know, it's sometimes people play that kind of card as if, oh, I've never done anything, but I've amazingly won this. And they actually, when you look into it, naturally did well at certain things. And then there will always be people that struggle like hell. They find it difficult to fit it in, to do it, to, you know, their trainability is perhaps lower. But then that's half the fun, finding what works for you.
It is. I mean, like you said, genetics is a massive thing. There's no two ways about it. I mean, you could look at parents, grandparents, look down the line and go, well, yeah, they...
Yeah, but not 100 quid genetic testing.
No, 100 to 200 pound genetic test. But you can look down the line and get a rough idea of going, well, yeah, granddad was pretty good at that, or grandma was pretty good at that, and, you know, my mum and dad have been all right at that. And you can look at that and get a rough idea, but that doesn't automatically make you a champion, like you were saying.
Yeah.
You know, I know some fantastically gifted people that are just, they just don't want to do it.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. You know they can do it.
You're about your boss.
No, not him. But, you know they are genetically gifted, but there's got to be an element of, I call it self-propulsion now, where you have...
Oh, do you now? You're doing your own terms now, are you?
My term for it, yes.
Right.
You still got to get out of bed and do that training. You know, just because you're genetically gifted doesn't alter that.
You've just given me the idea for the second T-shirt in the range. We got
powered by self-propulsion.
No, just self-propulsion.
Can you be
just
powered by self?
Self-propulsion. I mean, the first one was genius.
Yeah.
You know, that was genius. That's the second one already, self-propulsion. But yeah, there's got to be a drive and a desire, and the, you know, the Cavendishes and the Paula Radcliffes and the, you know, the Chrissy Wellingtons have got an innate capacity to go out and keep pushing and not let things, you know, not let too many things get in the way, and they will at all cost push through. But also, B, there is something in there that they also get, you know, a heck of a positive feedback from what they do. Because the last thing you want to do is flog yourself and do, you know, an ungodly amount of training and get what out of it?
Get
nothing back? That's almost the shame when some people are wrongly training themselves into purgatory, and you just want to sort of say, you're doing it not all wrong, but get it in balance.
Yeah.
And then maybe as the balance of your rewards and your input marry up together, you start seeing that it's all about, you know, even the best athletes, to be the best, they have to get it balanced right.
Yeah.
If they don't, they're off the rails, they're in just all the wrong places at the wrong time. If you look at situations that help you, those invariably end up being things that you scratch your head afterwards and go, yeah, but that was just the right thing to do. Whereas there are some people that even if you give them the right tools, they somehow manage to not do it right. Or say, yeah, but it was kind of raining. Yeah, it's all right, rain don't kill you. You've got to get out there and do it. Or, yeah, but I would have had to have changed the tyre and then, you know, it was easier to get a lift home. And you think, no, some people would have said, oh, I just ran home. What in cycle shoes? No, I took them off and ran barefoot. Oh, okay. And that would be the way that they would see the problem. So you've got to have a mixture of both your nature and your nurture. And some people's sort of nurture is such that they will always want to see, you know, what's around the corner. Can I push myself a little bit more? And as long as you get that right, it's fine.
Yeah.
But you know, Lee was right. There is a heck of a lot in genetics, which. My phrase is talent shines quickly, and by that I mean if you look at the, you know, the Radcliffes and the Brownleys and stuff.
TSQ.
If you look at it, they showed quite a lot of, you know, ability early on. Yeah. They weren't really, really mediocre, and then suddenly got good. There was this continual investment in getting better because everyone else is also doing it. There's no longer it's not the 1920s where a couple of rich people turn up, you know, do a sport and they're a champion. Now everybody wants to be good. And if it's something like running, where a lot of people on the planet can do that, you have to be extremely good to be able to, you know, earn your living. Whereas I guess, you know, there comes a point where every sport, it professionalises.
Yeah.
And you don't get anybody doing it on a, oh, look, he's riding around the Tour de France on a chopper. I mean, no, people like to sometimes play down how serious they're taking it. But when you look at the Sky thing, when you look at, there's been some really good videos on what it takes to win Ironman and stuff, you realise that, you know, to be good, you have to be extremely motivated. You can't just have a bit of talent and say, yeah, I just turn up. You have to want it so much more than the next person.
Yeah, and I think that they get to that point as well, that not only your drive, but obviously your makeup allows you to do that. But yeah, ultimately it gets to that point where everything's got to fall into place as well. So like you said, if you're in the wrong place, if you're in the right place at the wrong time, it doesn't come through. It just doesn't work for you. Yeah. Nothing goes for you, you know, and you'll get days like that. But yes, there is a massive factor built into the fact that if you've got the chromosomes to be good, it is a huge helping hand.
Yeah.
But you've still got to get your backside out of bed.
And that isn't meant to be negative. I think it always makes me think that people should actually think about what am I made of? Because there may be things that they don't, you know, they may be far smarter than a lot of people that they race against, and therefore they can, you know, they can eke out the best bits of equipment and the right nutrition and the right recovery and say, look, I may not, you know, supposedly be world champion, but that doesn't stop me, you know, winning my local race and beating people that always beat me. Or it doesn't stop me going, you know what, I'm going to go for longer, because longer starts to become about your head and your feeding and stuff, whereas shorter is much more about your, you know, your innate ability. So, yeah, nature and nurture.
Nature and nurture.
Okay, this is from David Sempierre. I hope I said that right. And he says, hey, Joe, and pause for effect, in brackets, Martin.
Hi.
Hello from the USA, a.k.a. NJ, New Jersey. I'm not even going to try and do an accent.
No, I was looking at you. Please don't.
No, please don't. First, thanks for the advice. Read the world's last year. In me not doing Switzerland and France back to back, I don't think I could have done both and lived to tell about it. One, got hit by a car after Christmas 2012, cracked my hip and left elbow. I've been back to full swing training and racing, finished the season off with Duathlon Worlds in Ottawa, Canada, short course, got the dreaded fourth place. However, I'm still in a lot of pain after rides, runs or swims where I'm doing a straight set with a pool boy. There seems to be no rhyme or reason as to when the hip will hurt. Could the pain not be my hip, but the band acting up, or perhaps the buttock muscles not engaging, making the hip seem to be a problem? The scans from the doctor say it's healed. A side note is I have to drop my saddle height after the accident. Tried raising it back to the spot pre-injury. No chance, that makes it hurt all the time. And the second part was, why is Team GB so damn good? Across the board, from duathlon, triathlon, pro cycling, etc., surely it just can't be beetroot juice and Vittoria tyres. Laugh out loud. Smiley face, smiley face. Love the podcast. Already gave it 5 stars on iTunes. David. So, I guess part one, get to as many experts as you can. You know, I'm always saying to people, you probably will come across people that will give you incorrect or not necessarily the best diagnosis or the best course of action, and then you'll find somebody else and it will hit the nail on the head. I think a bit like training, the area of rehab and of injury sort of prevention or just come back from accidents, it is a minefield. And I think there's even less direct knowledge about it because it's hard to ascertain sometimes what the full extent of the injury is. And it's not like training where we know what the full extent of what you're doing is. We understand what an Ironman is, or what, you know, now there's more analysis on mountain bike racing or what it takes to swim 100 metres and stuff like that. But you don't know with injuries sometimes the full extent as to what it's done to the body. So I think, you know, you just go to as many people as possible, even if sometimes it might even be out on a bit of a whim in terms of, no, we don't want somebody, you know, swinging a few crystals over your head. There's absolutely no rhyme and reason, but there may be various body workers that somebody said.
Oh, body workers.
Cool people.
Yeah, I know.
I didn't say body snatchers. Yeah. Body workers. And you get to as many people as it takes, and eventually somebody will be an expert in this area, and they will go, this is it. You do this, this, and this, and then this, and lo and behold, things start to get better.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a difficult one because the moment that you you know, you start cracking bones and causing massive disturbance to the whole structure of the body, the muscles and your habits and ergonomics in daily life all have to change because you are now a slightly different structure. And if you keep the same saddle height or the same chair, or, you know, go and see the same person who's always rubbed your back, you know, and done your legs and stuff, you may be barking up the wrong tree.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing,
have you had serious injuries ever?
I've only, touch wood, not major. I've only broken a collarbone and dislocated my ankle, but that was
that's
it.
Not wood. That desk is very high quality.
Laminated wood.
Custom built.
Yeah, sorry, I was just making sure I didn't curse in myself there. Yeah, and I mean, it is true. I mean, I ended up going to a friend of a friend.
Yeah.
Who was recommended to me by another guy who had a friend.
Yeah.
Who had a bad injury, and he was just like, so go see this guy. He's absolutely brilliant, but he will make you wince. You know, there's no two ways about it. He's pretty thorough, and he's it's a deep massage. So
Right. Anyway,
started to go to him, and the way I rule, or the way I mark people by if they're any good, is you only need to go back and see them maybe 3 times at the most, and that's it. They'll then turn around and go, look, there's nothing else I can do. Yeah. Come back when you've got any niggles and we'll see what we can do.
Yeah.
So with my ankle kept dislocating anyway.
Right.
Within, I'd go back to running and it would just pop out, and then that would be it. Pop back in again.
But your ankle goes off on its own.
Yeah, pretty much.
It just pops out.
Your shoe smells so much, you probably do.
Pops out, does 3 miles and comes back.
It's quite, it feels quite sore. But and went to see him 4 or 5 times, sorted it, a little bit of rest, and then, touch wood, never had a problem since, at
all. There we go.
So
that was finding the right person who knew the right person. Yeah.
And I think that's it. With the circles, is it David that kind of moves in? So I guess his triathlon buddies, there's got to be guys out there that, you know, have gone and seen. And I mean, even to be fair, Dave Joe's kind of recommended someone, and it wasn't my thing, but I went to see, to do with bone therapy, actually. Went to see this particular lady, and she's absolutely brilliant. And yeah, it got a few raised eyebrows off me to start off with, but was just told to go with an open mind. And ever since then, everything's been perfect. Anyway,
yeah. So. And I think, you know, I know people like to become, be it an injury or be it training, they like to really become an expert on it.
Yeah.
I think sometimes you're better just to think, okay, over to other people, I'll, you know, tick people off of a list, or I'll have a rationale, but becoming the expert is what those people do for their job. It's like when somebody tries to read so much and, you know, fully understand, you know, every bit about, I don't know, cycle racing or triathlon and stuff like that. It's like, look, unless it's your job, you're always going to do it probably with a veneer of information over the top of not a lot of experience.
But we're all armchair experts at a few subjects, aren't we?
But with injuries, yes. I think the time is spent searching out the people, not necessarily trying to work out what it is. Because unless you've got specialist equipment, I mean, you feel it, you know it, and you can pass that on to other people. But that's a bit like saying, I think the steering's not quite right on the car. Yeah, but that doesn't mean you understand what's going on underneath the bonnet.
That's and, right, yeah. And I think it's the tyres,
yeah. But I think you get to as many people as it takes, and you particularly find other, especially cyclists who would have probably decked it more times than triathletes, and say, right, somebody's got to have had a similar thing to this. Who did they see? What was the person? Right, I'm going to try those people, because you don't want a generalised person who does a bit of occasional, I don't know, loosening of runners' hamstrings and quads and stuff to try and aim at trying to sort out, you know, a massive hip and elbow and all other places that have been, you know, mashed. Part two, why is GB so damn good? I guess, you know, endurance-wise, we have always been, you know, we are very orientated towards, I think, outdoor sports. And I gave this some thought, because when it came in, I thought, what is the difference? And I think one of the things is, and this may not sit well with people, but I think it's a case of, we have yet to fully get what I would call the American diet fully affecting our population. Because if you see what a really bad diet can do for people that used to be super athletic, and they eat, you know, too much, over-processed foods and stuff, eventually anybody, absolutely, you give Bradley Wiggins enough burgers over enough, you know, months and days and years, and he will start to get heavier, it loses ability and stuff. And I wonder that at the moment we are so good because there's still a sense that we've always been into endurance, we've got not that bad a sort of a weather environment for people to do these sports. There's been a lot of structural changes in the sport, such that we've got good administration, but still enough to allow people to do it themselves. And there's been enough icons that other people say, I want to do that as well. So, you know, there's the nurture bit.
Yeah.
There's the nature bit, and there's the dietary bit, where if you can't just feed even the great athletes, you can't just feed them junk. And I think we are still just about on the positive side of there being not quite. I mean, there are a lot of people obviously that do eat very, you know, what I would say low quality and pretty over processed foods, and that is going to make a massive effect on the general population, on their kids, on their kids' kids, and therefore why would they ever grow up to be good endurance athletes?
I still think what's happened now is sports have gone from being, I think we're all a computer nation, pretty much. We'll still sit at our computers. We'll still, the kids will have computers to play with. But I think now it's all gone, and sport was always something, oh, you can go outside and do some sport. Mm. Yeah, go outside and do some sport. But now the primary schools have picked it up. You know, the secondary schools have picked it up. Even kids have started to look at stuff and gone, well, actually, you know, for instance, footballing obviously is the biggest, most highest paid sport that you could probably play at now.
Anyone say 86 million? Did anyone say that?
Absolutely unbelievable amount. But it's still inspiring people. Money's not the be-all and end-all, I know that. And especially and I feel sorry for sports like triathlon, you know, so professional athletes, they hardly get paid an iota, really, compared to what a footballer gets paid a week.
Yeah.
And, you know,
like Scott Nedley, who's won, you know, and perhaps Dave knows or doesn't know, but, you know, Scott Nedley has gone back to work because he couldn't earn enough as a professional triathlete. And then whilst still working and not being a pro triathlete, he's now won Ironman Wales. I know, and his summer holiday was go to Canada and train for 30 hours a week, yeah. And that was his summer holiday from work.
But I think
we don't have the money to support people, so some people will drop out of it. But fundamentally, I think we've probably still got enough money through things like lottery schemes and possibly just people always having that we can do it attitude. People don't just tend to sit back and say, "Oh, give me money, I want to do it." They will try and do it themselves. That sort of it is an amateur ethos in one way, that, oh, let's have a go at it. But at the same time, they realise if they do it and get rewards, they'll be okay. Yeah. But they don't do it fundamentally just for the rewards.
No. And if you pardon my French on this, and what's happened now is we've finally got our shit sorted, haven't we? Really?
Martin,
I do apologise, but we've got infrastructures now.
I think you mean the SH1T.
Yeah.
Yes.
We're starting to get our It organised. We've got people in positions where they're organising a structure, down from the juniors. I know a local junior that was selected to ride track. She was a surf lifesaver, she was doing the Ironman surf lifesaving circuit. They took her out, did some tests and said she'd make a really good cyclist.
Yeah.
Went out and did cycling. She just didn't get on with it. She's back doing the surf life-saving stuff now, and she's like a world champion at that.
Yeah. So I mean, you think there are, it's always easy with a few great talents to sort of think, wow, we've got it made with cycling, with triathlon, and there is a big pedigree of people that are doing it, and that isn't just down to funding. Some of those people were already on their own trajectory, and they would have done it come hell or high water. They would have done it. But it is interesting that somebody from another country perceives us to be super effective, because actually there might be quite a few very good earners that are very much household names, but there was a steep drop of that triangle. It drops so rapidly that the people that are with Scott and Eddie, winning, world class Ironman races, and yet they still got to go, back to work after a few days and crack on with that. And so, it's interesting because there is no one solution, but you can see that various ways of doing things, and people often doing it through their own methods where they're not strictly kept to certain confines, they still have their ways of doing it, that you do get the Wiggins and the Brownlees and the and the so ons. But it's very, very interesting, and I'm sure you could go on for hours, so let's get on with something else.
But it is nice that you said someone else rather than us being biased here has noticed it, and I pray to God, or I hope, that it's all completely legitimate with all the proper proteins going.
That's so. The other thing is that I think there's been a certain amount of naivety within British sports towards nobody's painting every prior sports person with a holier than thou name. No, there have been plenty of people that have crossed the line, but I think some people still said, I think I can do it and not be on the gear, or not do this or not do that. And therefore, if you do that for long enough, you will find talent that can do it.
Yeah.
Whereas if there were structures in certain countries, particularly with cycling, where the hotbeds were positioned in certain European countries, and that was it. If you went to a certain, and insert whatever well-known cycling destination you would like to insert at this point, why are the cyclists there? It's a great place to ride, but B, they've got an infrastructure there. Yeah. They've got certain things that happen. Of course, the more that people went to do that, the more that was, sort of perpetuated. Now, when the structure is about, good coaching staff, good support, seeing long term how people's career develop, then you can see that we've got a much better longer term, and there's good prospects coming through junior ranks. There's a sense that it is cleaner, therefore people that before thought, I don't want to do that sport because I know what it takes to win, now will say, I wonder if I can do that.
Yeah, excellent. Good question there.
Marco Farone, I hope I've said this right. Hi, Joan Crocker. Thanks for answering my question on the JBST podcast before. Just a few points. I did 10 hours of training per week. I understand the importance of doing no more than 1 to 1.25 hours in zone 3. Does it matter if I do these sessions on their own or during my zone 1 sessions? So does he mean do it, you know, one big batch or several bits? For zone 3 sessions, should I do these starting now? And he did send this in August, so approximately 3 weeks ago. Given I'm still about 11 weeks for my first try, or is there an optimum time to start these prior to the event? I keep hearing the importance of getting some hard, short sessions close to an event to bring on my speed. And finally, do I do my zone 1 training sessions right up to my taper, i.e. about a week before the event, or should I reduce volume significantly and just do zone 3 sessions? Okay. I know there's a lot of questions. I understand. there is nothing really in it for you to answer. It's for me. If you believe it, if you believe I purchased a training plan, blah, 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 if there's any other available, blah, blah, blah. And I said, no, we will get back to you on this. And I think, firstly, zone 3 stuff should be spread out because that seems to be a better way of dealing with the dosage. Otherwise, an hour and a quarter in one day's worth of training, I mean, that is, and it might not always be into zone 3. Let's get this right. You may be at the upper part of zone 2 and it may go into zone 3. If you're working hard enough and lactate is building up, you're in zone 3, even if your heart rate is still taking a while to get out of zone 2. Sometimes people flog themselves and say, oh yeah, but I wasn't in zone 3. You probably were, but it's a really difficult one to define where that point is. And it typically is about, it's probably about 88% of maximum heart rate, possibly. But you could be working, you know, really hard at, let's say you were doing a 10-mile time trial. You could be working pretty bang on your average at the start, and it takes several minutes for you to get up out of zone 2 and even approach zone 3. Mm. So don't always think that it's absolute time in zone 3. Sometimes you'll be working hard enough, but the heart rate either is slow to go up, or you're training so much that you can't get your heart rate up high, even though the work you're doing definitely is zone 3 zone work. Three, yeah. So I think spread it out over several days. You said you had 11 weeks to go. I'm reckoning now, based on when this podcast goes out, you're going to be about 6 or 7 weeks out. And that's about right, because that's your first race. And, you know, this is somebody, you know, dealing with an upside down format to us.
Yes, yeah.
People have come to the end of theirs. He's just starting. And I've got somebody who's moved over to Australia, and he's kind of going to do a second season effectively, because he's kind of had a few weeks of transferring and finding living, there
foundation,
and kind of just getting used to it. And then you go back up again, but it doesn't take long to start doing that top end. And as it isn't your only race and it's the first race, even a month's worth of 2 sessions a week of hard work, be amazed what 8 to 10 sessions of hard work training does. If it's built nice and gradually, you don't hit the first one and absolutely leave yourself
there. That's the biggest thing, isn't it?
Yeah, build on it. It's got to be hard enough that you go above lactate threshold, but the first sessions might be only just above lactate threshold, and then as you get closer, you're starting to do it a bit harder. You still need zone 1, and I think you've got to watch how much you do taper for this first one. You know, it depends on really how important this first race is. And sometimes you don't want to make the first race of the season your most important one, because guaranteed there'll be things that you're a bit rusty on. And maybe you treat it as a, you know, test of where you're at. And there'll be other races with which you can say, oh, I can now, you know, really put the icing on the cake. But it's such a difficult balancing act. But zone 1 keeps reinvesting in your endurance, it keeps your skill there, it keeps you just able to train and not just only ever be training hard. If you only did 3 sessions a week, said, oh, that's 4 days off, but I do 3 interval sessions and nothing else, you would lose the plot, because you'd only ever be getting on that bike or in the pool or running absolutely flat out.
Yeah, and I think also what you've got to bear in mind is it's accumulation of the hard work that you do. That's where the fatigue is, really. But again, you have to remember that the recovery is the most important part of your training. You know, you have to allow for that. You have to allow for that adaptation. But I mean, obviously, Joe knows better than myself, kind of with reference to racing up and tapering. But with things like intervals, I think you can. I mean, I chuck a few in during the winter, just literally, just to keep me interested, because you know the figures aren't going to be there. It doesn't matter what you were hitting back in the summer. You just know it's not you're not capable of hitting them.
So it's silly to try them. Yeah. You just really hammer yourself into the ground.
And there's no reason. But it is nice sometimes to get the legs and the lungs and going, and you go, I know where I need to do a bit more work when it's right.
Yeah.
So, but I think what people tend to forget is the accumulation, the build-up of fatigue that this kind of training does to you. Yeah. And, of course, my mindset used to be exactly the same. Well, surely I need to do more of it. I need to do more of this. Mm. And, of course, you get into doing more, and all that happens is you get more and more tired, which stops you from achieving what you should be able to achieve.
So I think, you know, four weeks of, even if you did, you know, the first 2 weeks you did two sessions, and then you did, effectively, you did the third week you perhaps did three sessions, and on the fourth week you taper back a bit. You still have got to work on this idea that the body can only take so much before you have to back off again. Yeah. And that would be in effect your taper week. So if you could start 8 weeks out, that'd be great. We might have missed that with the timing that you're doing, but certainly on a 4 weekly cycle would be quite good. But see that if you start doing some, and you're chomping at the bit to do some quality work, and it goes well, great. You can go back and do that. As long as it's probably, you know, 86 to 92% of max heart rate at the biggest effort, even though that might take a while to hit that point, and the intervals are 3 to maybe 8 minutes at a time, do 20 to 30 minutes of that, 2 or 3 times a week. I'll tell you what, you aren't going to get any more icing on the cake. No. That's it. You know, that will give you whatever is left to put you at getting better at pacing, feeling when you do go too hard, how the lactate literally stops you, and also getting your head ready to say, I've got to be able to do this sport at just below the point where it all starts to go pop. And I think that's the bit people don't realise about intervals, is there is merit in doing it sort of close to threshold on some of the reps, and then above it to get the real, you know, the real nudge of fitness. But to find out where you're still under control and where you're not under control is maybe why the elites have got such refined intervals, is that they've taken quite a few years to work out. I have to do this many watts for this, and because they are so conditioned, it works very effectively. Yeah. But even they have to adjust it when they're not quite right. And they don't say, no, I have to be able to do 300 watts. No, sometimes that won't happen. Maybe, you know, your equipment's different or you're just not on it. And if you do that summer effort in winter, it's not going to happen.
No.
And as he's coming out of his winter and into season, it's a much better approach to say, just start dipping into that high intensity and, you know, you've still got to do zone one. That's your training for skill. That's your training for the hell of it, for fun. And it still is warm-ups and cool-downs from these sessions. So you're still getting training time in there. And he's at the position where we would find ourselves, you know, next, you know, February, March to April, a lot of people
just have. Starting
and,
to come
and
on,
you know,
yeah.
You see the volume just plummet, and people go into this, particularly if they're short course or short time trial, or, you know, they kind of do stuff an hour or less, maybe sometimes they might approach 2 hours. They're not like the Ironman people that are starting to ramp their volume up. They almost drop the volume like a lead balloon and almost start doing too much top end.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, it brings on their form, but it goes nowhere after that.
Yeah. That's a good question, actually.
It was,
Have you answered all sections of that?
Yes.
Oh, good.
Yes. Just checking, are you?
Yeah.
this was from, and this one came in tonight, actually, from Stephen Gore Brown. And he says, hi, John Cocker. Here's one. Do you advocate...
Here's one for you boys.
Do you advocate taking time off after the season's hard training and racing, or simply backing off for a bit and ticking over? The older you get, the harder it is to get back from a block of downtime. I read in Bradley Wiggins' book that he took 5 weeks off after the Worlds and then started training again. It's not something... So that must have been Worlds 2012. It's not something I've ever done. 2 weeks was the max, but I'm just interested if there are real benefits. Hormone levels to return to normal, adrenal glands to recharge, muscles to fully repair. I'm aware that once they start training, pro riders can be doing 30 plus hours a week to build fast. But in some ways, amateurs who train, work, have families and other commitments can get more drained than a pro athlete who can recover and sleep during the day. Interested in your thoughts on this detraining versus full recovery and health restoration. Steve, brilliant question. Thank you. I think it is really important to... I've always got this triangle, health, fitness and performance in my mind. And I think if people don't realise how much all of these sports can take out of you, we're not on about, you know, Joe Jogger goes on the block a few times. I'm about people that push themselves in, you know, hard enduro mountain bike races, in Ironmans, in, you know, you name it. They push themselves. And it's really difficult to realise that at the end of the season, you are probably more tired and beat up than you think.
Yeah.
But ironically, give somebody a couple of weeks of downtime and they start saying, oh, I feel quite fresh. I reckon I could have a go at doing something now. And it's all just bravado.
Yeah.
And we can think that we're ready, but then you go and try and do one of the efforts that at the peak you were doing and you realise, actually, I'm still tired, and you know what, that niggle on my knee isn't getting better, and you know what, I really can't be bothered. That's the bottom line. When the race season stopped, it stopped.
Yes.
The good thing with Wiggins is he knew after the Worlds that was it. Somebody didn't say to him, oh, do you want to come and do a club time for next week?
Yeah. Did you fancy doing that other race in France?
We've got hill climb. Do you want to come and do it? I mean, that is one thing that professionals are far better often, not always, but far better at doing, is realising there's so many, you know, shots in the barrel. Yeah. And so they don't just go hitherto and try and do as many things. It's the amateur that, you know, hits the last season and then says, oh, yeah, but I reckon I'm still all right, actually. I think it's good to get your full money's worth out of the season. But at some point, you do have to stop.
Yeah.
And I don't think you stop. I quite like training because it's, you know, we live in a lovely place. I've always been active. I like just going off for a run or, you know, biking or, you know, even going swimming, actually. And it's good because I see the benefits as being just about health, mental well-being, thinking time, you know, your own personal time. That is invaluable. Whether you can measure it or not, difficult. But you've got to do the right thing for you.
Yeah.
And it might mean that he's got more time off. Steve might need a month off because he's done his knee in. You might do 2 weeks of reduced time and then go, actually, I'll ride to work a couple of days and I'll start doing this. It's not really exactly what you do in your time off. It's how you gradually build back when you do get back on it. Because October, November, December is still not the miracle months. No. Even the elites are being very cagey about how much they do and when they do it. And I think it's very easy for people to even think, oh, I took 3 weeks off and I feel brilliant. Now I'm going to go at it. Whatever you do, you start back slowly.
Yeah. Well, the thing is as well, is it's like Steve, Joe and I harper on about is...
We harp on about
you have to give your credits back, if you know what I mean, and you have to earn your
credits. Brandy points.
You know, that kind of couple of weeks off, and I know being an athlete, in your head they'll be going, oh my god, we've had 2 weeks off, that's it, it's all done, I might as well sell all the bikes and the swimming kit, and it's never coming back. But
I'm a husband.
That's it. And you have to bear in mind is that if you have family, you know, if you've got a job that's quite heavy going, and it might be seasonal, you know, your busy time might be the winter, it might be the summer.
Yeah.
You eventually, you're burning, like we were saying, you burn that wick at both ends. Mm. It's going to come to the middle where you're just finally going to go, oh, yeah, I've had enough of this. And something gives up, or something bigger and better takes over, something more important that you then think, well,
yeah,
I can always go back to that. That's not, you know, yeah, and excuse me, like Joe was saying, you know, when you come back, that is the biggest problem people tend to, or the biggest mistake I think people tend to make is, and I must hold my hands up and say I'm guilty of that as well, is you kind of stop doing it for a bit because you think, I need this rest, so yeah. I need to have a break.
Which is right.
Yeah.
You shouldn't be on a plan that says, I don't take a break, I've got to keep going. Do you?
No. And then you get to that that couple of weeks off that you've had, and then you end up going, oh, no, I need to get back at this. And then, of course, what, like you said, the first thing you do is you look at your train diary, well, that's where I finished. I've only had a two-week rest. Mm. I'll crack on from there. And then everything else is out of kilter. So the season is done. If your season is done, draw a line in it. Mm. You know, just go, well. And for me, the season finishes and I sell all the bikes. You know, everything goes. It's as simple as that. And, of course, you then get that bit of downtime when you're waiting for the new stuff to come in, et cetera, et cetera. So that's a natural break for...
Yeah. Yeah.
For me, yeah. And you know, I've been off the bike now for probably 2 months because the season finished quite a while ago for me.
Yeah.
But I've always done stuff like I've gone out running, which I've hardly done any running for ages, and done a bit more, and just quite enjoyed the different aches and pains that you get from that.
Yeah.
It's not a complete rest, I must admit, but then. Because I'm not under so much pressure to train all the time, you look outside and go, oh, it's raining. Oh,
but I think the other thing is that, you know, there are, the, you know, it is, you know, it is Wiggo's job, and it isn't, people that listen to this, unless you're listening, Brad, and very nice to you listen, thank you very much, but it's amateur. It's not what you do to get the money in
That's
the bank.
You pay your mortgage
for the roof and the feed the dog and the cat and the kids and anybody else. So ultimately the balance of favour has to go towards other things, and it is the brownie points. And I think it's important that, you know, that you do pay it back. I always see that, you know, certainly September, October, I know I will work more just because there's almost a mindset to say, well, whatever you do now, you don't have to do in 4 or 5 months' time. But work is what you do. And if you always, which you could do in any of these endurance sports, you could always find something just around the corner that you could then, oh yeah, but there's this sportive coming up. And then you could have another reason to say, oh, I've got to do this session and this session and this session. And I don't think I take... I stop.
No.
I was trying to find a period of time where I'd stopped for more than like 2 weeks, and I can't remember ever, seriously ever having done that since wherever the training diary is. I found my first training diary. And it's not because it isn't like it's a compulsion to keep doing it, because I wouldn't count, you know, 3 20-minute runs and a 1 hour bike ride, you know, as being compulsive. It's just it's you know, when particularly when you work from home a lot of times, it's the way to get out.
Yeah.
It's the way to do chores. It's the way to, you know, to do errands and to do stuff. And what it isn't is, oh, I've got to do my 12 hours of training a week. And I think depending on everybody's circumstance, you've got to see what would a logical, smart person do given that situation. And if you've got to the end of the season and there are niggles and there are things that, you know... I suppose I've got scenarios from people that have, you know, they've got a child is about to be born, or they've just emigrated, or they have done the last race and there's a few niggles and they need time off, or they are going to do some serious damage that could affect the whole next year. Each of those situations requires a slightly different view, but none of it ever says we can't stop. You're on the big plan, because that then means that whatever time they do have to take out of their life and whatever things they do to get onto the start line, that's going to get worse and worse. And let's face it, let's be very frank and true. Racing is incredibly selfish.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you know, elite athletes, bottom line, are fundamentally selfish. They've got to be. They have to believe that they are the ones that count and they get on and do it. Because if they worked out all the people that do want their time and stuff, they'd never get out the door.
No.
But if you realise that other people support you, if you realise that it's about keeping it in balance, then actually having time away just makes you better next time round. Because you have given your body, yeah, the hormonal recharge. A bit like in every month there should be a lower week, in every week there should be a lower day, you know, and every year there should be a lower month. Just whereby you let the body sort of recharge. And also, mentally, you can have these eureka moments that says, I know what I want to do. Whereas if you're always used to doing the same thing week in, week out, people don't get off that treadmill.
No.
Therefore, they cannot take a slightly different perspective. And like, perhaps you've gone, oh, actually, this run is all right. I might do a bit of this. And you might say, oh, it's all right, but I don't really. But unless you change and try something different, you'll never know what it is.
No.
To see things from a different perspective.
I mean, that's the whole thing. And also, especially, I used to think if you've had a bit of a... Maybe you've not performed the best you thought you could this year. Sometimes it's quite nice just to go, right, we'll back it down a bit then.
Yeah.
We'll not feel guilty that I'm not going out training and, you know, I've had a glass and a half of wine for dinner.
Oh, Martin. God, you know how to live, don't you?
I'm a crazy man. You know, it's not all then been... You know, aliens haven't come down overnight, sucked all your training out of your body and left you kind of horrifically inadequate, you know.
Oh, I thought that did actually happen to people. I'm sure somebody's given me that question.
It's happened to me many a time.
Okay.
You know, you can then look at it and go, well... And like you said, you get that odd eureka moment where you're sat there going, well, I suppose I didn't really look too much into... my tyres, into my position, you know, I've just stuck with the same tyres, the same position that I've had for a while on the bike, and, you know, I haven't had my swim coach for, you know, the last 6 months, so, you know, maybe I need to be looking at that, or change swim clubs, things like that, you know, and you'll find that you've, just because your head is kind of out of the sport for a bit, you just turn around and think, oh, right, maybe that's an avenue I need to go and have a look at. And then that gives you time just to explore a bit.
Yeah.
And then before you know it, you know, that week's gone, or those 2 weeks have gone, and you're back into
it. As the saying goes, and I'm sure somebody took a lot of time to get it right, a change is as good as a rest. And it is. You know, part of rest is changing things a bit. I say to people, let's make September eclectic. Let's do things a bit different. Just try, go and you know, ride with a group you never ride with to see what it's like, or find different pools or whatever. I think there is a need to have a, you know, an annual cyclical nature to what you do.
Yeah.
So you have to define the end of the season. And there are people that really don't like that. You know,
they don't like the shot.
But there's this sportive, and oh, but I found a half marathon, and oh, there's this. And you think at some point, just take the, you know, take the competition and put it on the back burner.
Yeah.
Because it isn't, you know, it isn't as if it absolutely should ever define you. There's got to be more aspects to people, and I think that actually, when you do that last race and you absolutely leave it all on the course, it's actually quite nice, because that's that whole cycle done. If you have to find the next thing and the next thing, actually, you know what? You're addicted to always feeling as though there's a reason to have to shove you out the door.
Yeah.
And there shouldn't be. There should be a real balance to it, where people say, oh, is it all right if I don't train for a few days? Oh, God, knock yourself out, of course.
Mm.
You don't want to have to be compelled, because there will be a time in 5 months' time where you have to get out the door. And I don't want them, for somebody to say, oh, yeah, but I was kind of a bit, you know. I had a classic example of a person who, you know, did mammoth training at the wrong time and was being told to do less. And when it came to actually needing to do more for their Ironman race, they ran out of mojo.
Yeah.
And it was a classic case of, look, that's why those big numbers you did a couple of months ago, which I found out about afterwards rather than be asked about it.
Yeah.
That's why they were a waste of time, because they actually, you know, they sapped it out of you. We haven't got unlimited resources.
No.
I think people sometimes think they can just keep doing it and doing it. And you see it and you can predict when it's going to go pop. And then people go pop and go, oh, yeah. Yeah, I kind of
thought... You were right there.
Yeah. I wasn't a good idea to go from triathlon straight into road running and cyclocross, and get to February and go, oh, I'm a bit knackered.
Yeah.
You know, we have limited resources. That's not to say you have to limit your, you know, your goals, but I think it's a really good thing to, you know, to actually embrace having time where training isn't the first thing that pops into your mind. You actually get, you know, as I call it, admin done. You really look at your methods. You look at the time to save. You perhaps even, you know, change to, you know, putting the alarm clock on earlier and say, yeah, I don't have to be getting up early just to do training. I'm going to get things done that just make my whole life better. Because if your life is better, then training in the future will be better.
Yeah, that's it. Oh, good question, that. I like that. It's been really good, actually.
And another one. from Blakus Pondus.
Oh, not that bloke.
It's about rehab. Question for podcast. How long does it take to return to full fitness after a forced break from injury or illness? In brackets, 14 weeks, no activity. Worth mentioning, I will mention the second part in part B. So, okay, enforced break, this is longer than an end of season thing. You know, if you're having no activity for 14 weeks, then yeah, your body goes backwards. There's no doubt about it. You know, nobody stores fitness and it stay there. Obviously, the longer you've been doing things, the not the quicker it will come back, but the more that was there anyway. So, you know, Blake has got, was it fourth last year at the National 50?
That's right.
Yeah. So, you know, very good engine, very good ability. And he dabbled with triathlon as well prior to
that.
Stuff like that. And I think a bit like, it's part answering Steve's prior question, because I meant to add it, but I'll add it now because it's relevant to this one. You're only ever training your genetic ability. So whatever you do, if you have an enforced break, okay, an injury could affect somebody's limbs and it never, ever allow them to produce the same amount of power. But fundamentally, it's the same person that you're training back again. You just have to be ultimately respectful that 14 weeks of inactivity is starting afresh as far as your body's concerned. But like initially, and I'm sure with Blake, initially started doing stuff. Oh, he's pretty good at that. Oh, he's getting on quite well at that. And that would happen in the training.
Yeah.
But you have to just wipe away, you know, the wattages, the distances, the groups that you train with, the courses that you choose, even the amount of times that you do stuff, and start very much back at Billy starts all over again mode, and just really tick along. Because as long as you don't impede your progress, there's no reason with most illnesses and injuries for people not to get back up to where they were before. And you sometimes find this if you take, you know, an extreme example of somebody that, you know, is injured and as a able-bodied athlete was really good, gets injured and is a para triathlete, a Paralympian later on, you realise that they're still training the genetic capacity.
Yeah.
The only difference is somebody's actual, you know, innate capacity to produce what before was obviously there. You are training your genetic ability, and as long as the person can work out that that's what they're doing and they don't panic, they've just got time on their side.
Yeah.
You know, and say, do you know what was there is still there. I just cannot, you know, when particularly when somebody is incredibly fit, it's amazing what you can throw at them and they can just do it and just come out the other end smiling. Whereas with this, it's back to look, some of the things that you would have laughed at before are going to have to be your new habits.
Yeah.
Because you cannot just do it. You cannot just throw the sessions and the head-to-heads that you'd have with people into your week, because you won't even get a few days into it and you'll start to think, oh, it's all lost. You have to nurture yourself long-term. But you know what? 14 weeks, it would probably take, you know, that and that again to eventually come back to where you were. But it's what you did before the injury that's most important, and you've got to bear that in mind, and you've always got to have that. It's almost like in a very small way that if people have done a race and they've done well in the summer and they get really like depressed and down about the off season, and I always say, look back to what you did last year. That was still you, but that was you at your best.
Yeah.
That is still there. It's not going to happen just by the fact that you just say, oh, I'll do that all over again, no problems. You have to work for it, but once you've been to a certain place, it should be possible to get there or get very close.
Yeah. I think also what maybe it might do or help, especially with an injury or an illness, you know, there's a lot more people out there, I think, willing to kind of help you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And even though I think sometimes if you know these people are really good athletes, you know, and you almost want to be part of them getting back to their peak, if you know what I mean. So so things like going for a ride with a group that you might not have gone with before, you know, there'll be plenty of people out there, you know, teammates or friends or athletes out there that just want to go and ride and just have a chat and you know, get you back into your training. You know, there's plenty of people for that. Also, you know, if you do think that after this certain amount of time off for an illness or an injury, you know, if you think, like you were saying, if you think you're going to be hitting those numbers that you were before, it's just not going to happen.
No.
So number one, you have to be realistic.
Yeah.
But I think in being realistic, you then have still got to remember the, you know, the way you felt when you were doing these big numbers, because that's got to come back. There's no two ways about it. But like any other athlete, you know what's going to happen. It'll be after 3 weeks, you'll be like, that, well, why isn't it coming back?
Yeah.
And it doesn't happen. And kind of knowing Blake and the way that he has trained, then, you know, he will be expecting that. He will be going, right, well, you know, I want to start seeing these improvements. Yeah. But
which is part of the question is, like, what you know, what does it take? Because I think it's, you know, it's always difficult for anybody to be in a situation, and it's, and having seen people have, you know, quite serious accidents and come back. And a good example is Chris Goodfellow, crashed in Lanzarote, you know, and they're in, what, about 18 months later, you know, Triathlete magazine did, you know, they used the headline, you know, coma to Kona. But that was it, you know.
Yeah.
That was it. That's what happened. And you kind of realise that it was still with a, you know, with very few differences, it was still the same person you were training.
Yeah.
And I think when somebody knows what they've had potentially before, that should almost be, you know, not oh, I'm going to get there in X weeks. I think if I do it gradually, do you know what?
I will get back there.
Yeah. And very, you know, very sort of talented athletes. And, you know, Blake, you are in that category. You've got something that everyone else can't even train to try and produce. So you are training something that is a V12 engine, and, you know, the rest of us have got V6s. So you don't have to do a lot and you will get a lot back.
Yeah.
The worst possible scenario is when somebody, you know, kind of breaks themselves physically and possibly mentally because they don't nurture the body back.
Yeah.
And there's a, you know, there's either an aggressive deadline set that they want to be ready for, or their confidence in what they're doing takes a knock by the fact that they aren't quite ready for the head-to-heads that they would normally have. And I think it's very difficult. I would say it's probably the, you know, the place where two brains are better than one, because you can kind of nurture somebody along, yeah, and say, I know what you're thinking, this, this, and this, but don't worry, you know, like you say, the numbers will come back. And you and I could train, we ain't getting those numbers.
No,
that's what people, you know, and I know there are always, always, you know, detractors that will, you know, argue that somehow if they put their mind to it, they can do anything. No, you can't, because you come to my house, stand in my garden and say that you're going to jump to the moon, and I will say you won't. Okay?
Yeah.
And you know, you can have a big audience here, you will not jump to the moon. And we have to see that we are training what we've got. The hard part is dealing with all the other bazillion things you've got to do, sometimes re-motivating yourself to get back to, oh yeah, I really want to get back to doing, you know, Project X. And I think that, you know, with rehab, it's as much a mental game as a physical thing.
Yeah.
But like a training plan, you've got to think before you get out the door, because you cannot just roll into what were normal habits. It's like, right, you know, this is Project Get Yourself Back to Health and Fitness. Forget about that performance bit on the top of the triangle. It's health and fitness.
Yeah.
And then you realise, injury, recovery from a race, end of season rehab, it's all about just taking enough time to let your body repair. And we are training ourselves back to get to, you know, our 99th percentile. It's when people don't give themselves, they almost think that it is forever upwards.
Yeah.
They can just keep training. They don't realise they are at their 99th percentile. If they batter themselves more and more at that level, you won't get 101%. You will just go down. Yeah. And you will go down, and you will mentally, physically, or both together at the same time on a certain day, a certain part of a race, go bang, pop, wallop. And people can literally end their endurance sports in a flash and say, I don't know what I've done to myself, but I don't want to do that ever again. And you can see elites sometimes do that. That's probably the Steve Redgrave scenario, you know, had to do that and didn't want to get in a boat again. And also, you know, there is a sense that it probably is different to have to do it day in, day out, even when you don't want to do it. It's different when it's part of, you know, a whole structure of, you know, he's still, you know, he's still still connected with sport. And as a mechanic, he's helping lots of other people. But you don't necessarily have to produce, you know, great times to actually ever still be helping other people or be enjoying your training. No. You know, I think there's an element of happiness. And some people, when they've done their career, their Ironman, their, I don't know, Land's End, John O'Groats, they're quite happy. They can draw a line under it and they don't have to say, oh, yeah, but next week I'll do this and I'll do this and do that. And there are some people that I don't think it is motivation. I think, and I don't think it is drive to keep going, because at a certain point, nobody's got infinite drive to keep pushing and pushing and pushing. There's got to be a happiness factor where you draw a line under and go, right, what's the next thing to do that, that, you know, maybe, do you know, I'm going to take a year out and just, I don't know, you know, go to yoga once a week and get on a surfboard. I don't know, but there has to be differences to how people do things.
And I think with kind of like, especially with an injury or an illness, you know, you I think there is a mental part there, quite a big mental part, where you'll look at it and just go, I don't know whether it'll ever happen again. You know, you don't know that until you can properly get back and start doing your training. But and like I said, I think from Blake's point of view, is I think it's a quite a nice opportunity to kind of have a bit of a rest, take a bit of pressure off yourself, and kind of look at certain other things that maybe you kind of you've been doing or haven't been doing, and you might like to do, and you know, puts things into perspective a little bit more. And then once kind of the injury or the illness is sorted, you're just like, right, well, I want to get back on the bike, or I want to get back in the pool, or I want to get back in, you know, doing some running. And then, again, start going out with groups of people you may not have gone out before and use them as the ladder to climb back up, because these kind of people will want to be in your company, want to help you, feel as though they're helping you. And then obviously once you're back up onto podiums, as it would be, you know, there'll be people there going, oh, we used to go out riding together. Yeah.
And it takes time, doesn't it? That's the other
massive
thing.
Amount of
time. You know,
time.
And it's easy to sort of see that people do something and you don't realise how many hours they spent chipping away to get to that point.
Yeah.
And therefore, even though they've got to a certain level, how quickly you can get back up there. I think almost every stage there has to be a sense of, you know, is the brain and the body being nurtured or is it being flogged?
Yeah.
Because like, you know, like horse racing, you only nurture something over many months and years. You don't just kind of whip it and flog it and see how fast it will go in on day one. And I think there are people that are a little bit like that. They kind of almost, you know, put themselves through purgatory, and it won't last, and unfortunately it won't give them what they could achieve. You know, the saying, the light that burns twice as bright burns half as long, and it's true.
Yeah.
I think there's a sense you want to be thinking, no, I'm not always going to, you know, under train and under achieve and, you know, try and limit what I'm doing, but just look at what nurturing yourself can do. And you know, there's so much, just when people have been injured, when they can just get back to doing it, they can just have a revelation of, wow, it was so good to be able to do this.
Yeah.
Because 6 months ago, I couldn't even get out of bed, and now I'm doing this. And it puts it into a context that really does then give them, you know what, some of it is about the fact that I just love doing it.
And it's all about perspective as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you can see those incremental gains that you're getting, and it's all about perspective, getting a perspective from that incremental gain by going, well, I couldn't do that 3 weeks ago, or, you know, I couldn't ride at 150 watts for... you know, an hour and a bit, you know, I couldn't do that 3 weeks ago, but now I can. Yeah. And it's comfortable. And it's nice to see those incremental gains or advantages that you're starting to get. Mm. You're starting to get that fitness back, but it's then going, right, well, I reckon I can hold 200 now for an hour and a half. You know, you could just get used to kind of getting back to feeling like the old you, and then, you know, your progression will come on from that anyway. So
absolutely. I was going to say, I'm hoping to get Scott Neardley on a podcast.
Cool.
I don't know when. We're just sorting out some software so that we can do it over Skype. He's currently working outside the UK, so we're going to try and do it. We want to get it done as soon as possible after Ironman Wales, and just go through some stuff. If people, hopefully we'll be able to do it, if people can kind of hear what it's like racing at the front of a race,
yeah,
directly from somebody about what's going on and how they're, you know, sussing out other people and stuff, it gives you really exciting insight into it, because we're not going to be at the front of the race, let's face it, unless you and I make a race up and nobody else knows about it.
We've had a race like that before. Yes, we didn't make it up though, did we?
No, neither of us won it.
No, I won it.
No.
I had to come back and get you. I claimed I did double the distance.
No, you didn't. You didn't get to the turn. You did not do 50 miles.
I did not. I did 125 that day. In the van.
In the van, yes. But it's really nice to hear it straight from somebody. And, you know, and also being surprised at certain bits of the race going, I didn't expect to be at the front. You know, what's going on? And that hopefully should go on in the next week or two. So that'll be out after this podcast. That will be number 122. And we will also next month do another Q&A. There were some Q&As that couldn't get done today. And it's good to have just a whole batch of them, which brilliant questions. Thank you, everybody, for sending them in. Sorry for the ones that we couldn't get around to. If you're listening to this and you want something answered, then tweet, send it through the jbst.com website and we will get back to you. If you want one that is just personal and you don't want it mentioned, I can do that as well. But I think it's quite good when people can let us have their details that we can put these out and make it hopefully informative, something where this is going to go out in October. Somebody will be sat on the turbo trainer or out going for a run, listening to our dulcet tones, hopefully giving them an ounce of inspiration.
This is it. This is what we aim for.
This is what we aim for.
Just the ounce.
We aim to be.
Just the ounce of inspiration. Yeah.
So any reviews, please pop them at iTunes. That would be much appreciated. The newsletter will be going out in a week. The in-between podcast information will go up at the Twitter feed, which is at Coach Joe Beer, also at Safewalk Racing, for latest products and information from the Martin Crocker hotline, I think it is. And once again, thank you for downloading. We will come back with a Q&A in a month's time. Test, test, test. 1, 2, 3.
Oh, we're testing, are we?
We're testing. Test. Test. Right, Henry, put this at the end of the podcast, can you?
Test. Wait, why does he have to put the test at the end?
Because people don't want to listen to this at the beginning.
All right. Test.